exotic. Substitute one letter and you have erotic. Rearrange the letters and you have toxic, tick, talk, and exit. Mind's Eye Radio would like to entice you to visit them in their favorite get-out-of-here places. Some real states and other states of mind. Got your sunscreen, sunglasses, miner's cap, aqualung? We're off to the exotic places, or where else we'd rather be.
That's so exotic.
Yes, it is. On the next Mind's Eye Radio. It's radio within reach. Exotic. Substitute one letter and you have erotic. Rearrange the letters and you have toxic, tick, talk, and exit. But before we exit today, Mind's Eye Radio would like to entice you to visit them in their favorite get-out-of-here places. Some real states and others states of mind. Got your sunscreen, sunglasses, miner's cap, aqualung? We're off to the exotic places, or where else we'd rather be.
That's so exotic.
Yes, it is. Guyther Waldson literally visits an exotic place, but he has ulterior and quite local reasons for telling the tale.
I liked where I grew up. A small bayside Long Island town, a good and safe 60 miles away from the wilds of New York. I was intensely happy there, so much so, as an adolescent, I considered involving oneself with strangers from the next town to be a severe breach in loyalty. When I was 16, my parents invited me to travel with them to their native Norway, but I refused, too afraid I might have missed something happening down at the corner store. And even though I was an avid reader, relishing tales of Jane Austen's windswept moors, Pasternak's snowscaped Russia, Melville's world-traveling whalers, I was very content to be an armchair traveler, staying put there with my friends, where, as they say, everybody knew my name. But then, somewhere around the age of 22, my life seemed to take on a life of its own, tearing me away from my bucolic town. First, it was tailing my ex-wife to California in hope of reconciliation. And then, while waiting for her to reconsider, I thought I'd finish my schooling. It was there I met an Australian woman, and by the next Christmas Day I was swimming at Bondi Beach in Sydney. But school ended, and so did the relationship, and as a result I got to worrying about the lack of community and spiritual underpinning in my life. And so for the next 7 years I spent living and working for a spiritual community in the north of Scotland. While there, in close proximity to Europe, I became deeply concerned with the problems facing Russia in the Gorbachev years. And soon I began to work on citizen diplomacy exchange programs, matching young Russians with poor inner-city Glaswegians, an exchange which eventually brought me as far as Irkutsk in Siberia and, oddly, to Botswana in southern Africa. Now I live, of all places, in the Midwest, still a good 1,000 miles away from my childhood home. I've been home for Christmas once in the past 25 years. I now am officially a world traveler, but not via any long-held dreams or rich underpinnings, but by default, stumbling along in my life trying to answer whatever question or problem that has been at hand. And of all these places, one of my most compelling and exotic experiences occurred not in the Australian outback or the boundless Kalahari Desert, but rather on the bone-cold northern coast of Scotland, edging up against the foothills of the Highlands. Each January 11th, in the small neighboring village of Birkhead, there occurred a wonderfully strange festival called the Burning of the Clavey. As far as I could tell, it was a New Year's celebration, and its roots dug deeply into medieval times. The clavey itself was an oak whiskey barrel, sawed in half and mounted on top of a stout pole, each year using the same nail to keep tradition. Then the half barrel was filled with oak staves and pitch. On the night of the burning, using a smoldering bit of peat from the local provost's fire, the pitch in the barrel was set ablaze, and a local man, who was deemed the Clavey King, would stoop below the great barrel, grasp the mounting pole, and in an almost superhuman feat of strength, hoist it to his shoulders. And, almost Christ-like, begin the journey through the narrow cobbled streets, followed by what seemed like the entire, mostly well-liquored, populace. As it was January in Scotland, the night inevitably brewed cold and wet, the damp wind howling, sending black smoke, large sparks, and embers spewing from the fiery barrel. The goal for the townspeople was to retrieve one of the embers and place its charred remains on your mantelpiece in order to bring you good luck for the upcoming year. Occasionally, the clavey bearer would stop next to a stone wall in order for his assistants to throw more pitch and staves into the barrel. Around him gathered blackened faces of the town, their eyes hungry and gleaming like polished glass, returning us all to a scene that might as well have been 1285 as 1985. Again he would hoist the barrel on his shoulders and set off down the lane, the crowd in a sort of crazed tow. The grand finale consisted of a long slog up a rise at the edge of the village, and tipping the barrel over at the stone altar of an old fort at the base of Dury Hill, setting the entire grass hill ablaze. Afterward, still mainlined into the adrenaline of this spectacle, we all wandered back into the village, searching for a cozy pub, a warm place, a pretense of returning to the present world. I say pretense because, as I sat with my friends over a beer and a steaming plate of mashed turnip and ham, I wasn't sure I could ever truly return, that no amount of scrubbing would ever remove the dark pitch that had seeped beneath my skin, nor the fiery gesture of hope that came out of that darkness. How I got there from my small Long Island town seemed a lifelong series of coincidence and blunder. Whether I now cared how I got there was another story. This is Guy Thorvaldsen for Mind's Eye Radio.
If you go out on the moor of a night, in the mist of the dawn or the pale moonlight, well, it's there you will see them dancing all alone, with their eyes on fire on the cold, cold stones. So take heed of the warning I do give. Never dance on a Sunday as long as you live. Fail not to hearken, heed what I do say, or you'll dance with the damned till the judgment day.
Poet Norma Gay Pruitt was delighted to find a cache of old love letters one rainy afternoon. They transported her to places she had forgotten she'd visited, and in one case she traveled with someone who apparently got lost with the luggage.
Finding love letters, or who the hell is Steve? I might relate how we hunkered in the bracken, and you encircled my brow and waist with salt-washed bracelets of weed. How neither of us inlanders could quite confront the drama of the sea. I might say how we cowered most of one first day, you playing my mandolin heart, and both afraid our pink and speckled skin would flame. But that exotic place, tropical in the deep of winter, was just the beginning for you, world traveler, but a kind of period on a period piece for me. I gravitated backwards as you moved on. I retreated into the safer while your star glared. Yet nothing that could have protected me, really, in my mundane and small-time dance, did. And, according to these letters, I went on bashing hearts and meeting lances for some years, while you went merely to France and maybe Algiers. As I excavate, the detached archaeologist, these ice sheets and hot sheets, strata of thin parchment and fine-point pen, or notebook standard and typewriter manila, I find man after man, all peat bog fellows now, as one after one describes my eyes and I see theirs. Then I hit a vein of carefully crafted poems describing some summer now evaporated into jet trail, all ravey about my chestnut, was it ever more than brown, wavy hair, and gray, oh come now, these can't be my blue eyes, but addressed to me and pouring out himself, his missing me, the smell of my eyes, ears, elbows. Who is Steve? I called to my husband, who had made me sort this box of billet doux to start with, while cleaning out the very unexotic attic of the 130-year-old house. I wait while he fumes and pouts. After all, I have been calling boys' names out for half an hour, his name only once or twice. Is the poem good? Well, then, I'm sure you are mistaken. That Steve must be me. I'm dubious, but all day long have a special pearl in my heart. All these now departed, some literally, and their letters, exotica in the middle of my pie crust and stair-dusting, matronly day. This is Norma Gay Pruitt, She of the Eyes That Impress, for Mind's Eye Radio.
What's so good about the Badlands? Writer Matt Filgus tells us.
Badlands, 1994. Strange rock formations in finger-like projections. A large formation suddenly in shadow as the surrounding area is illuminated. I sit in the center, having moved to be in the middle of this, away from all connection except within myself and of the rocks around me. I am not thinking much here. There is a peace I feel, perhaps in not thinking much, yet it crosses my mind that I should be thinking more. Further off than I realize, a camera shutter snaps. I can hear it next to me. I don't care. I feel part of the rocks. I wonder if I am contained within this stranger's picture. This is my goodbye to the trip. 5 weeks, 7,000 miles of wandering in my truck, a giant square of the United States. I said I'd be back by now. Eroded rock encasing me, everything barren, containing only brown. Softly chirping bird, insect buzzes my ear like the whistle of a freight train, approaching, then passing. Constant din of crickets. Two lone rocks sit in the center of the canyon, a few feet of space between them. I wonder if they'd prefer to be closer or further apart. Cannot help but believe they'd prefer closer. I become aware of my watch ticking. I adjust my arm so the sound fades. I can't put a time to when I am finished. With the top of my pen, I make a small X in the parched, crumbling brown rock of the floor. I am feeling. I consider writing this in the dry ground. There was a woman in Santa Fe who struck up a conversation. She was Navajo, Or maybe Hopi, with a long white braid trailing down her back. She offered to show me the hills behind her house, where she said the people fleeing California lived. She was angry that she worked and paid taxes, and those homeless living in the hills did not. I regret not talking longer, walking around Santa Fe with her and taking it in from her perspective. There wasn't enough time, I believed. I said I'd be back by now. The space between the two rocks, the peaks rising up from the canyon floor in strange designs, different shades of brown, the tufts of dusty grass, the sunlight and shadow equally sharing this space, the insects paying me no mind, my baseball cap beside me, the X in the dirt, my thoughts to leave something more in this place. I notice a rounded hill to my right, one smooth mound in a world where all else is angles. I close my eyes before closing my pen. There is a part of me that does not believe the trip is over. That part may never believe the trip is over. That's a part I do not want to lose. This is Matt Felgus for Mind's Eye Radio.
There's the one about selling ice to Eskimos, and then there's the one by John Morgan.
Welcome to The Bob Granger Show. I'm your host, Bob Granger, and tonight we're going to be talking about exotic places. We have some interesting guests lined up, so let me introduce the first one. And now, here is Gordon Hoffowitz. Good evening, Gordon.
Good evening, Bob.
Welcome to the show.
It's my pleasure.
Well, Gordon, I'd like to start off the interview tonight by asking you a simple question.
I think I can handle that, Bob.
All right. So, who are you anyway?
What do you mean, who am I?
Well, I've never heard of you before in my life.
What do you mean you never heard of me? How come you got me on the show if you never heard of me?
Well, it wasn't my idea. It was the producer. She told me, by the way, you're going to be interviewing Gordon Hoffowitz tonight. Gordon who, I said.
Well, didn't she tell you who I am?
No, she was in a hurry. She just rolled her eyes.
I see.
So are you famous or something?
Well, I'm in the Guinness Book of World Records.
Do you know how many people are in the Guinness Book of World Records? A lot. And most of them aren't famous, just like the encyclopedia. Ever see all the people in the encyclopedia? They're all famous, but no one's ever heard of most of them. So it's possibly be famous and obscure at the same time.
That's what a wise man in the Solomon Islands told me once.
What were you doing in the Solomon Islands?
Selling refrigerators.
But I still don't understand why you're on this show. Are you one of those people who's famous for being famous? Because if you are, I've never heard of you.
I am a famous refrigerator salesman.
I see. So you're in the Guinness World Book of Records for selling more refrigerators than anyone else in the world, right?
Exactly.
Now I'm beginning to understand. So you must have sold refrigerators all over the world. So you've probably seen a lot of exotic places.
Oh, I've seen a few. Besides the Solomon Islands, I've seen the Kalahari Desert, Bali High, Nepal, Monaco, Fiji, Togo, Constantinople, Peshawar, Zamboanga, and Mindanao.
It's Istanbul, not Constantinople.
I knew it. I just like the old name better.
Well, you've certainly been around. About the most exotic place I've seen is Bogalusa, Louisiana.
Yeah, I've been there too. Spent a night in Bogalusa once. In a hotel with a leaky toilet that ran out across the hallway.
That's where I stayed, too. I went down to wake up the old guy at the desk to tell him about it, and he said, I reckon you better just step over it.
That's what he told me, too.
Isn't it a small world, Gordon? You know, in all your travels, I bet you've even sold refrigerators to Eskimos.
I sold 3 refrigerators to an Inuit tribe in Canada. They call themselves Inuits now.
I knew it.
Yes, Inuit.
I said I knew it.
But you said Eskimos.
I knew it's Inuit, but the expression is still selling refrigerators to Eskimos.
I knew it.
Well, if you knew it, why are you making an issue of it?
Excuse me.
Could we talk about refrigerators and exotic places?
I thought that's what we were talking about.
Now I lost my train of thought.
I knew it.
Will you stop saying that? All right, why don't you tell us some of the exotic places around the world where you have sold refrigerators?
Well, I sold 4 refrigerators to a Bedouin tribe in the Kalahari Desert.
But the Kalahari is in Bechuana land. The Bedouins live in the Sahara.
They were lost. They decided to explore the jungle and wound up in the Kalahari.
They probably didn't bet on that, did they?
No, the Bedouins don't bet. They have a saying, if a Bedouin bets, he better win. Otherwise, he'll be sent to live with the ostriches.
So, he'll be ostracized.
Exactly.
So, did they pack these refrigerators around by camel?
No, they left them at the oasis.
Where did they get the electricity?
Didn't need it. They just filled them full of dried dates.
Well, you're a pretty good salesman.
That's why I'm in the Guinness Book of World Records.
So, Gordon, you must have made a lot of money in your career.
Made a lot, lost it all. Lost it all betting on an alpaca race in Peru. Should have known better than to bet all my money on an alpaca named Pokey. The stress was so bad it affected my pituitary gland. I grew 6 inches in 6 months. So I went to a doctor. I said, Doc, I'm having a problem with my pituitary gland. He said, there's nothing wrong with your pituitary gland. You just don't know how to say it right.
Did you ask him for a second opinion?
He said, if you want a second opinion, I think you're crazy. Then I remembered a medicine man I had met with a headhunting tribe on the Amazon. I went to see him. He told me I had acromegaly. That's when you keep growing when you're supposed to stop. So I said, Doc, I know you can shrink heads. Can you shrink me back to my normal size, to 5'9"? Took a couple of weeks, but sure enough, he did. I've been normal ever since.
Well, Gordon, it's been a pleasure having you on our show tonight. It's been great talking to you. I'm sure our audience has learned a lot.
Thanks, Bob. It's been my pleasure.
So, where are you off to next?
My next stop is down at the Corner Tavern.
Ask any Westerner about exotic places, and chances are the scene will turn to a place featuring scimitars and incense with perhaps a turban or two. While all would admit that exotic is a matter of perspective, it would be difficult not to commiserate with Renaud Catalani as he tells a tale of a Christmas Eve in a very foreign place.
Some years ago, about this time of year, I was far, far away from home. So far away that even today I still get blue just thinking about that place, that time, so blue. I'd squeezed into a dawn train mixed in with a sleepy boys' school. Classes canceled. Our train jerked into a roll. Night retreated across those grand lazuli heavens. Tehran descended into chaos. Both sides of Iran's revolution were fully committed to letting boys' warm blood soak deep into the Persian plateau's thirsty soil. Shah Pahlavi already trucked desert-lean Turkoman units into downtown intersections. Anyone on sidewalks after 7, they shot dead. His secret police had already disappeared all those poets, professors, and student protesters. It was high time for any Nadi Kratchang holding a satanic American passport to get the heck out of town. Our long southbound train settled into that bluesy rock track trains everywhere do. Bad things, very bad, happen each time our train slowed into an angry sea at big city stations along our route. Very bad. Not to me, or anyone small, or dark, or quiet, but to travelers tall and blonde. By the time we banked into the eastern Zagros moonscape, no more Westerners rode with us. Blood-drunk boys and men had fallen into dark exhaustion, and I slipped off our train. By Christmas Eve, I made a nasty border town, Quetta, the meanest place on the planet, Baluchistan. For 1,000 years Gatda's main street had been the camel caravanserai, for silks and curries from China to Istanbul to Medici commerce. Most Baluchi side streets are committed to murder, the rest to mayhem. Shop after shop spins spinning out blue steel barrels, tap-tap-tapping out iron Kalashnikov hardware. Next alley, men bent on clang-clanging out curved steel swords, shirt-sleeve daggers. All of it only deepened my so bad blues. So what do you do when you got such blues in the baddest corner on earth, Christmas Eve? Easy. Find a Chinese restaurant. They got them everywhere. Look for the obligatory gaudy red storefront, Ching Chong signboard, sit yourself down. Chinese corner cafe fares always, everywhere, the same. I was in heaven. No matter that a gruff Uyghur lady in both a Russian floral dress and a Minnesota canvas pants dropped a miserable menu on my grimy red vinyl tablecloth. No matter that dinner choices ran in Arabic right to left, I sounded out each syllable of my Christmas Eve selection. Chicken chop suey. Sweet and sour sheep. Rice, a mountain of it, if you please. That's what I said, and I handed her back her menu. She looked at me long, maybe fingering her hidden dagger. Maybe figuring if killing this oily bug's worth the work of burying the body. I looked back at her. Got tea? She looked at me. Hokkaido green's okay, and Tupelo honey if you got some handy. And you know, madam, you have an uncanny resemblance to our dear Auntie Suri, if I might say so. She looked no more. She marched to her kitchen and yelled something nasty at her cook. My tea never came, but a Christmas feast did. Celery chop suey with a lot of peanuts and a little chicken. And everyone's favorite, sweet and sour sheep. But pig or beef or hen, no matter, it's the sauce that counts. Bright red sauce. Sauce that stands alone once cool. Sauce samples they show at D.C.'s Smithsonian, a leggy ant or a Chinese rice weevil encased in each ancient gob. Amber, a gem favored by Han empresses and Baluchi truckers and svelte Madisonians on dangle earrings, on teardrop necklaces they make of petrified Chinese sweet and sour. So, ayo, with ethnic so in, with blue so near, next year, along with green holly and yellow bells, remember the red sauce. This is Ronat Latang Sayanka Talani for Mind's Eye Radio.
In the second half of today's show, exotic places or where else we'd rather be. As we take a tour of the Solomon Islands, a real druid ceremony, a museum of gold, and many, many more places.
Oh, that's so exotic.
Yes, it is. Hasn't seen the eerily beautiful shots of Stonehenge at the solstice, at least on educational TV. Well, what could be even better? Fran Rawl tells us.
It was high drama. Stonehenge at dawn, Midsummer Day, 1973, watching a druid ceremony inside the stones. Due to Teddy Boys staging a riot the previous year, security was much in evidence. people outside on blankets, police patrolling with German shepherds outside the razor wire, which encircled the actual stones. We could see the ceremony, but had no idea what was being said. The Druids wore white full robes. I don't know if there were any women represented, saw a lot of beards. Seeing it through the barricade was sort of a shock. Police pacing back and forth, reinforced by the dogs. Evidently, the riot last year had been really something. I had spent most of the night before facing the truth that I was either too old or too stodgy to drive the 2 or 3 hours alone in the dark. Plus, in England, you needed detail maps, even for small trips, as I knew to my cost. So it was with joy I found a note from my father-in-law, stuck back in a corner when I got up to heat a cup of milk. It said, "Aunt said he would be here at 5 a.m. to drive to Stonehenge with you." There was a question mark after Aunt. He was not to know that was Anthony Peters' nickname. I was dead tired, but immediately got a food and coffee packet together, got dressed in time to answer the soft rap on the door, and put Aunt's bike in the garage. I had asked several people, including Big Lewis, to drive with me, but no luck. And here was Aunt, who had heard about the trip from a woman in his house, who had finally decided she could not take time off from her job. "Our dear Anthony, one of our first contacts in Oxford not connected with our job. He had responded to our request for a guide by showing us Oxford, punting on the Charwell, which joins the Thames at Oxford. He even wore his gown for us. Another fond memory was the stern hand he clamped down on our shoulders, admonishing, 'Do not stare or say anything.' We were at Westminster Abbey in London, and there was Princess Margaret with her two sons being shown the coronation stone by a high church dignitary. What a way to learn history. The stone has now been returned to Scotland, but I believe the chair is still in the abbey. At any rate, Aunt was telling us that one did not stare or comment at royalty, just a side glance in silence. So it was somehow fitting they had come to show me Stonehenge at dawn, Druids inside, police and dogs outside, along with us in the field, larks rising with song. Lewis, the husband, was working in Liverpool, Denise, the daughter, back home in America, in-laws home by their choice, just me, transfixed in history. Later, Aunt talked to one of the Druids packing up his car. He was a carpenter, he said. I was too tired to take it all in. I'm sure Aunt had to drive both ways, and I have no idea if he ever did such a thing again. My catching a note of the event in the paper had set off the whole thing. Maybe I will have to ask him in the next Christmas letter if he ever went again. This is Fran Rawl, reporting for Mind's Eye Radio, A Glimpse into the Past. I have read Stonehenge is very much restricted now, and I have no idea if Druids celebrate there anymore.
Sometimes a place can only be described in its own context. Writer Esther Cameron feels that may be true of Israel.
I first went to Israel in August 1979 and lived there for 10 years, with approximately annual visits to my parents in Madison. Since returning to live here in 1990, I've been back 6 times, each time for a scant 2 weeks crammed with visits and conversations. So altogether, I must have made 15 or 16 times the transition between 2 very different realities. And each time the transition is different. At times, I've been tempted to compare Israel to a black hole from which no light, that is, no signal, no information, can escape. It's that hard to report the experience of Israel outside it. On my last visit but one, in October 2002, this feeling resulted in the following poem. Liaison. I have returned from the lonely land of prayer that waits and thirsts for mercy and for rain. Could I ever tell you what I found there? Ads and indifferent faces everywhere were all I saw when I got off the plane. I have returned from the lonely land of prayer. Before I left, some told me to beware, or blamed the people for their haters' pain. Could I ever tell you what I found there? Between the blasts they're searching, those who care, to find the oil to light the lamp again. I have returned from the lonely land of prayer. If on my face you cannot see the glare of that light in which history is made plain, could I ever tell you what I found there? To the great city where scare after scare ripples them all, and wealth is on the wane, I have returned from the lonely land of prayer. Could I ever tell you what I found there? I just came back from there again, and again it was a little different. What I felt this time was not only the pain and searching within Israel itself, but also a constant and painful awareness of what is going on outside the country too, in the world as a whole. This feeling is epitomized for me by a conversation with a physicist and Orthodox rabbi whose family hosted me on this visit. One Friday afternoon, just before the Sabbath, we watched a program about an Israeli pianist, Penina Zaltzman-Schultz, whose work has an amazing vitality and a rich romantic sensitivity. A few days later, my host said to me, "There is so much beauty in the world, like the program on that pianist, and yet there are such horrors. In the Sudan, 1.5 million people are dying at this moment. They're dying." I never come back from Israel without a heightened sense of the value of life and its tragic endangerment, and a deepened prayer that the love of life may help us all to overcome the destructive forces in the world. I'm Esther Cameron for Mind's Eye Radio.
Traditions shift and meld into each other in a busy street observed by poet Judy Zuckerman.
Dapper marked. A willow hangs over the canal, over children's fishing poles and shoes in a row, sheltering ducks, herons, and swans, swaying toward the dapper marked near the corner. Pausa bargains, hood cope, and the beat of Turkish tunes. Galabeas graze the ground worn by bearded elders. Neighbors in African cloth weave through crowds, seek turbans, old Dutch Amsterdammers, bicycles and strollers. Nieuwe herrings with pickles and onions on broodjes. Falafels sizzle in oil to vendors' Egyptian songs. Stalls of fish, saris, and Vietnamese lumpias. Caribbean drumbeats drift over the neighborhood Tropen Museum.
Poet Oscar Morelis brings it all down to earth for us, reinterpreting the exotic.
Mayan artisans had a sense of humor. You could tell by the way their gods squatted, sometimes with one arm raised as if asking for directions or hitchhiking, or elbow rested on their knee looking for a newspaper to read. One Mayan statue had an added appendage. Maybe this was the original Latin lover. This is Oscar Morelis for Mind's Eye Radio. Ding 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 ding
Gorse is a fast-growing weedy shrub common throughout the Penwith Peninsula. It forms the backdrop for Sharon Van Sluis's tour of ancient sites.
Tour of Ancient Sites, Chysoster at Galville, near Land's End. Even the frowsy cows I passed on the narrow muddy path up here think it's a mystery. Their eyes asked why this high grassy field, so near, is not theirs to graze. They have bellied the fence with their longing and leaning toward the sweet wind-lain blades, uncut, no maintenance planned in this lonely, unpeopled off-season. It is late February in the Iron Age village. I pass the unmanned ticket gate. There, gorse-choked foundations, muted rock, aged smooth by the wind's rough hands. I wait. The ruins seem simple stones again, retreating from history, the grass inviting the cows to eat. This is Sharon Van Sluis for Mind's Eye Radio.
Madison writer Paul Thompson and his essay, Dandelions.
Biologists call them exotics, those plants and animals that have invaded our nation from abroad. Most of them, finding a new environment free of natural enemies, flourish at the expense of native species, and some, like the African killer bees, can even endanger people. Others, however, are relatively harmless, and a few are even real additions to our lives. I know many homeowners will disagree with me, but I would include the dandelion among the additions. Dandelions originated in the Middle East and spread in prehistoric times through much of Europe and parts of Asia. The British ensured that the sun would never set on the dandelion. As the Brits colonized far-flung regions, the dandelion went with them. The first dandelions reached our shores with the early New England settlers. The seeds may have arrived in the fodder carried for cattle aboard ship, or in the seed collections of housewives, for dandelions had medicinal and food uses. The name came from England too, originating in Latin and French. It means tooth of the lion, which may refer to the jagged edges of its leaves or to its herbal properties. Dandelion is a diuretic, causing the body to get rid of water. The young leaves, picked in spring before the plant blooms, make a salad or cooked dish. The blossoms make dandelion wine. The leaves or roots can be dried and used to make a pleasant-tasting tea. The root, ground and roasted, makes a kind of coffee, reputed to be gentle on the stomach. There's even instant dandelion coffee. If you don't want to make your own dandelion tea or coffee, you'll often find them in natural food stores. As ox-drawn wagons traveled westward, the dandelion traveled too. For the dandelion, let's face it, is a weed, one of those plants that has evolved to flourish in disturbed environments. Years ago, my youngest daughter, refusing to cry after being spanked, announced that I'm a tough little nugger, while the dandelion is a tough little nugger, too. You'll find it growing out of sidewalk cracks, at the edge of fields, and, of course, in your lawn. Its deep taproot is almost impossible to pull out completely without intensive digging, and householders and farmers have to resort to chemical warfare to eliminate it. Although the dandelion is classed as a single species, it actually is almost a cluster of species, each varying slightly from the others. These variations enable it to survive in different environments. The dandelion is primed for explosive growth in the spring to get its seeds spread as quickly as possible before the competition. The dandelion shoot is a marvel of engineering, a hollow cylinder for maximum strength with minimum material, held erect by the water pressure in its cells. Bees and other insects find the blossom a good source of nectar to tide them over in spring until more plentiful blooms arrive. But the dandelion doesn't depend on insects for pollination. It can pollinate itself, but actually produces most of its seeds without any pollination at all, the plant equivalent of virgin birth. Dandelions bloom only for a few days, closing their blossoms at night or in cloudy days. Then the flower closes for the last time, to unfurl again as the seed head that children love to blow away like a cloud of tiny parachutists. I once counted the seeds in a single blowball and found 219. A mature plant can produce from 18 to more than 100 seed heads. So an acre of dandelions produces millions of seeds, spreading them for miles if there is a strong wind. As you may have guessed, I don't conduct chemical warfare against the numerous dandelions in my yard, nor against the violets or the creeping Charlie. Live and let live is my motto. I like the piebald colors of my lawn in spring. They'll be inconspicuous all too soon as the summer comes. Meanwhile, I can look out my window at the rabbit nibbling the dandelion stems in the dewy morning, clipping each stem off delicately at the base and devouring it with steady nibbles, like someone sucking up a length of spaghetti. Enjoy, I say. Bon appetit. This is Paul Thompson for Mind's Eye Radio.
Ho-hum. The doldrums of the same old, going to work, coming home, rising just in time to do the whole thing all over again. Lynn Patrick Smith knows the drill, too, but he helps us wake a little in Crosstown Bus.
On the bus path, Rita eats a donut. Coffee is about to spill. She's sitting next to Ned. He loves his cologne, but the rest of us aren't so thrilled. Expert Eddie's always non-stop talk. Almost every day he misses his stop. And today I don't wanna get off this crosstown bus. Dreary Doris wears a hat and a heavy coat. You'd think that it was much colder. Nurse Nancy's newspaper is open so wide. The Taylor twins read it over her shoulder. You need exact change or a monthly pass. There are no exceptions. I see these people almost every day. Some of them I know by name. I have named some of them for their idiosyncrasies. I'm sure most of them have a name for me. I feel like backseat to Larry. He only talks to himself. The mix of his musty clothes and the diesel smoke is a fragrance I know too well. Most of them are on their way to work or school. I'm off to a career I didn't mean to choose. And today I don't wanna get off cross town bus. No, today I don't wanna get off this cross town bus. I don't wanna get off. No, I don't wanna get off.
This is Lynn Patrick Smith with Janet Smith for Mind's Eye Radio.
All right, let's count heads. Are we all back on the bus? Does everyone have his or her passport? We hope you enjoyed your virtual trip around the world today. As we traveled in realms of gold, imagined ourselves as Druids and Scotsmen and Africans, Caucasians and Solomon Islanders, and that's our show. Thanks for listening to Oh, That's So Exotic, written by the Mind's Eye Radio Collective in Madison, Wisconsin. The show produced by Kelly Warren, very exotic, and co-produced by Gay Davidson-Zilski, also exotic. The show was written by Esther Cameron, Runo Catalani, Fran Rawl, Oscar Morellis, Sharon Van Sluis, Paul Dobson, Norma Gay Pruitt, Judy Zuckerman, John Morgan, Matt Filgus, Guy Thorvaldsen, and Lynn Patrick Smith. Original music by Barbara Chusid. If you'd like more information about